You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to Counter Stories, our regular conversation here on NPR News by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. And then there's me. I'm Tom Weber. I'm with NPR right now, but just for a few more days, and happy to be here for one last Counter Stories during my tenure at NPR.
Thanks for being here, Tom. This is Hui Lee. I'm the owner of the Other Media Group.
Don Eubanks, associate professor.
Yes. Congrats.
I got tenure and promotion at Metropolitan State University and cultural consultant.
And Anthony Galloway, recently installed executive director of Arts Us Center for African Diasporic Art and Culture.
And Luz Maria Frias, usually also with us, not here today, but hope to have her back soon enough for sure. So you're listening on the radio to this on Thursday morning. We're recording this Wednesday late afternoon. In fact, as we sit here, a lot's happening. President Trump is still en route to Duluth, so we don't really know what's going to happen in Duluth, so we're probably not actually going to talk that much about it. But obviously, the bigger story related to the administration has been playing out this week, is this the separation of children from their families at the border with Mexico. You know, we always sit down here and decide what we're going to talk about, and it didn't seem like there was going to be a lot of disputing whether we were going to talk about that.
No dispute whatsoever.
You know, just today, and it was interesting. At the center, we have a summer camp running right now, and got a chance to see that an executive order had been signed, stopping the separation of families. But what I found intriguing was the statement. So one of the statements, this comes from NPR News, Donald Trump speaking.
The president, yep.
And he said, "We're going to keep families together, but we will still have to maintain toughness or our country will be overrun by people, by crime, by all of the things that we don't stand for and that we don't want." And I found that language very intriguing, especially the "don't want" piece. I mean, the data is very clear that it's not criminals coming over the board largely, that is largely a myth. It's not who's coming over. And the toughness and the rule of law and all this stuff and how often that language comes into account, especially when we're talking about people of color or people of color, especially who challenge somebody's ideal of America and things like that. So I just found that very striking. And in this whole time and all this conversation, we pivot right to rule of law and the undesirables and stuff. This is a different way to me of saying the same thing. And it's this continuation of this mentality that goes along with that. That was one of the things that stuck out to me in looking at some of that language. Right?
The I think the thing that stuck out to me most about this whole situation is, a couple of things. One is a lot of people feel like, you know, since I don't have children, I don't know what it's like, or I shouldn't have strong feelings towards this. That doesn't matter. Okay, that I don't have children. I have strong feelings about this. Mm. I have nieces and nephews, and if you try to take my dogs away from me, right? And imagine if they were humans. Be like, yeah. Tiger mom, crazy over here. The second thing is, I've been amazed at just how polarized the country has been over this. It seems like every time an issue has come up in this administration, it divides us even further. And this is such a moral line that it's just dividing us even further. You know, I have friends who are Trump supporters, and we are still friends. But now I'm like, I can't even look at you if you think it's okay for children to be separated from their parents and put in cages. And what I'm told is, well, it's not that bad. Did you see where they're staying? It's not that bad. They compare it to boarding school.
So that was a nod to Don right
yeah.
there.
Well, Indian boarding schools.
You're talking about boarding schools, and your reference was directly to the Indian boarding schools
yes.
that were separating Native children from their parents.
American Indian policy yeah. to...
But they're using that as a good thing. They're like, oh, it's just like boarding school.
Oh, right, I see. Right, you're right, saying right. that in
yeah,
conversations
they were,
you...
Yeah, they were making that comparison, you know, and it's, you know, I think what Anthony's brought up and what you've brought up is, you know, I think the things that come out of President Trump's mouth as he, you know, labels individuals like he did in his proclamation. And when he uses that kind of language, it electrifies his base to the rest of us, we hear this divisive, dividing language that he's established because we, the power is in who gets to name it. You know, the first time I heard him utter that he's doing nothing but following the law. Oh, by the way, the law that the Democrats created, and that it's the Democrats who created this whole situation. And as president, all he's doing is following the law because that's his job. You know, he immediately, when I heard that explanation, I thought, wow, you know, his ability to try to spin this, because we know he never assumes or any hates responsibility for any of his actions. It's always directed either by someone else made me do it, or I'm doing this in relation to because this was already here. And so he assumes no responsibility, and then the rest of his administration falls in. Well, you know, even if we look at laws and policies, many of which have been unjust against communities and populations of color, indigenous individuals, African slaves and African Americans, and other populations. We interned the Japanese during World War II. Although there were more German spies, we didn't intern Germans. We interned Japanese. My mother was one of that part of the last generation that was taken from the reservation and sent to boarding schools.
Your mom was.
My mother was. Yeah, that's how close I am to this policy of removing our children from the American Indian community to wipe out our language and our culture.
Did she ever talk about, I mean, she was taken as a child, right?
Yes.
And mom and dad couldn't come with her.
No. You know, we're talking, a lot of people refer to these events as historical events. I graduated from high school in 1973, and it wasn't until 1978 that they passed the Indian Freedom Religious Act that I could practice my Native American spirituality without being arrested. That's 5 years after I graduated from high school. So we're talking history that's not that long ago, and that's continuing. So when people argue to me or tell me, well, you know, America has been separating children of color since the slave ships. This is nothing new. What's shocking is that it happened so quickly, and it was used as, he was trying to use it as a bargaining chip to get his wall funded.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we had a conversation about, I think it was two Counter Stories episodes ago, about the reverberations of lynching, when we were talking about the lynching memorial.
Right.
And, you know, the pattern that keeps coming up, right? We're reminded of all of these things all again, seeing the images and seeing what's happening here. But there was actually an interesting unifying, not dividing factor amongst Black Christian, I'm a seminarian, you know, and there was an interesting unity happening across racial lines within Christian communities, even amongst folks who are perceived as Trump supporters or not Trump supporters, but more conservative, because there are a lot of conservatives who are not Trump supporters, right? Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure that's clear. Even within the Black community, there are folks who are conservative and agree with a lot of the kind of conservative platform, but definitely not Trump, right? You know, to keep us out of being in this monolith. But there was this unity around how ridiculous this is, and especially when the attempt to quote the Bible in response, which as a seminarian—
To justify doing it.
Or it just it didn't even seem like a justification. It seemed like a passing quip that was just something that was thrown out there without a whole lot of thought. That's the only way it could be, because anybody who has studied particularly that scripture understands that contextually that means exactly the opposite of that. Paul himself was a very counter-government person in his in it. But anyway, but I digress.
He had his own counter story.
Exactly. He had his own counter story, right? And so especially when that happened, there was this unity across folks. So where you had, Lee, where you were saying you had folks you can't even talk to over this issue, I'm actually finding folks who I haven't been able to talk to for a while that I'm actually starting to talk to.
That gives me hope. Because I think that, you know, a lot of these people, they just say, it's the Democrats, and they try to, they play the two-party game. Mm-hmm. And I just want everybody to step back and say, okay, let's stop talking about Republicans and Democrats and talk about these are children, you know? And I think once you get to that level with them and you really are able to show them that, that these are children who have done nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. These are children who are very, very young and they're sitting in cages. How could you not cry when you see that? How could you, you know, how could it not hurt you? And let's just get rid of the politics, okay? You, even if you support Trump and I don't, let's not argue about Trump. Let's talk about the children. And I think that's what I'm hoping that all this stuff that's happening, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that that's what it gets us to do is to talk about the issues and not about the parties.
And I just, because there is so much politics involved, I'm just going to point out real quickly that I, in my personal life, have a connection to some ongoing politics. So I'm going to wade a little differently into this. But one of the things I heard you say, Haleigh, then heard from Don, which I think is an interesting question to ask, is because you were saying that some of the responses you heard to the separation policy was as a point of, look, it's okay. You heard people say, well, look at the American Indian boarding schools. It worked okay there. And then, of course, Don tells us the story to counter that. I mean, you have hope, Anthony, but where does how do we traverse that?
Qualify that?
No,
qualify
I know
that hope. in that the hope was exactly what you said, Haleigh, is that finally we leave this kind of dual this dichotomous conversation that is left or right, Republican or Democrat. Because I have a lot of Democratic friends who are tone deaf to this in their own ways, right? There's a healthy critique. And I think, Haleigh, what you brought up is very important, that while dominant culture tends to be two-party, and Don, you've spoken to this too, right, that communities of color in discourse, in dialogue, in community, it's not a two-party conversation. There's healthy critique for all the parties mm-hmm. who've been in power for a whole lot of different reasons. You know, when we want to talk about separation, this policy, you know, under the Democrats, I mean, let's be very clear. It's the Trump administration's decision that led to this uptick in the separations. That didn't have to be done, even though the policy might have come in under Democrats. Right. But that is not, that pattern itself is not new. A lot of the separation, a lot of the monitoring of single mothers for welfare and things like that, or this whole idea of the welfare queen, mm-hmm. even though it was coined by Reagan, we still have a whole lot of Democratic policy after the switch of Southern Democrats to Republican Party. After that switch happened, we still have a whole lot of policy that was written by Democrats that are involved in its own type of separation, mm-hmm. from child protective services to assumptions about living conditions and the cultural deafness in that space too. So there's a whole lot of critique to go out.
So I wonder how you guys feel about this. I've seen a lot on social media, you know, separating families is American as apple pie. Right, because this country has a history of that, and a lot of the pushback on this from people is that this is not America, this is not who we are, and now people of color are saying, no, this is who we are, this is who the country is, and I don't know how you guys feel about that. Does that add to the discussion or does that take away?
But see, Haleigh, now you're touching on another aspect of what I sometimes will bring up, and I think that's. Because part of that discussion, and then part of what Trump was successfully able to do the past week with this, the creation of this policy, and that he so eloquently laid out for us in the proclamation he just made and the language he used, the true history of this country is never, ever really taught, because history is taught by those who were victorious, right? Much like that professor told me my freshman year at McAllister College, You learn history from the point of view of those who conquered, not those who were vanquished. So history that's presented in the United States is one-sided, and it cuts out what really happened during slavery to American Indians and to other populations of color in this country. It cuts that out. So when those things resurface, it's met with doubt by naysayers, because that's not what they learned in high school. It doesn't fit with what they've been told or taught. You add language, because one thing Trump is effective as is using language. And he did that in his campaign, and he began to set up the other. and the other was the immigrant, first with Somalis, then with Mexicans. And he's been consistent in using that language, the other, the rapist. I mean, he's used that language to set up this scenario that makes it okay for those individuals that you seem to be having conversations with who felt it was fine to separate these brown children and keep them in cages would be the same individuals that when they go on a tour of a slave plantation down south will turn around and look and say, well, oh, this didn't look too bad. The slaves weren't too bad off here. They had places to stay and they had food to eat. It's that same mentality that was allowed through language, because when white Europeans first came here, we, the indigenous individuals, were thought of as equals at that time because we had the same values. It was only later when they started growing and wanted the land and we were on it that they began to demonize us. Then all of a sudden we became savages.
So this whole thing where everybody is going, this has happened before. It happens to the indigenous people. It happens to the Japanese. It happens to black slaves. Is that adding to this conversation, or is now the time to educate people about these things? Or that's the question.
But Hilly, those were coming out, I think, from my perspective, to just say this isn't any behavior that's any different or new from white Americans who are in power. It's a repeat.
Right.
Those of us who have color, those of us who watched Trump's campaign knew exactly what he was saying, knew exactly what he was talking about, and knew I'm not surprised
at the effectiveness of it.
That's what surprised me. When we talked about the browning of America, and we talked about how, you know, in 2040, statistically, there will be more people of color. Remember that conversation we did in our counter stories? We failed to talk about what the impact of that would be on white America. We didn't have that part of that conversation. And this election of Donald Trump, I think, tells us clearly what many feel or fear of the browning of America.
Again, there is a boxing in of the multiple perspectives within communities that I'm not seeing in this dominant cultural discourse around this space. There's an assumption that black folks are going to be Democratic because that's where a majority of us vote, right? And the numbers pan that out in large part as well, largely because the Democratic Party has at least given lip service to some of the things that folks have brought up. But if we were to put action onto the table, there wouldn't be a whole stark difference between folks' feelings on either party. But one of the things that I'm dubious about is in this conversation around these children, we are really not having a conversation about what is driving people to this border. There was a very interesting discussion that happened at our center around who it is that's coming and why and the places that they're coming from, right? And there was a student who gave the quote from the Statue of Liberty, "Send us your poor huddled masses yearning to
Be free.
To breathe free." Yeah. And they were having a conversation saying, you know, these folks are fleeing something really poor. Why are we removing, you know, refugee status for folks who are fleeing these things? Why are we making a choice to ignore why they're coming and only focusing on their legal crossing space, where when similar conflicts are happening in other places, our conversation is very different? And that's what takes me back to that last line, those we don't want. There's like a dog whistle under there about the folks that we don't want, who's desirable and who's not, and a picture being painted of what that looks like, allowing us to turn a blind eye.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping that our conversation can shift to why they're coming, because whatever, regardless of what we decide about these children at the border, that is a symptomatic piece that we're addressing, not a root cause that we're addressing. And that's something that keeps getting missed in the conversation for me.
But you were wondering, I mean, your question also was rooted, Hilly, in, as you know, there is a lot of history that we could all stand to learn, but if you try to teach it in this exact moment when the temperature is raised, does that become a moment where people are more defensive and shut you out even more, and so that the ears are even more closed?
Yeah,
I mean, that
exactly.
That was the concern I heard.
That was the concern I have, and also just the fact that all of a sudden we've become educators again, right? Mm. We're in that situation where we, the people of color, have to educate the white people about their own history because they weren't taught it, like you were saying.
Exactly. You know, and I tend to agree with what Anthony just said, because what's missing from that conversation is what's driving these individuals. Mm-hmm. That's a long trek mm-hmm. from Honduras or Nicaragua. And thank God, you know, I mean, I don't
And by the way, going through Mexico isn't a free pass.
Exactly.
If you cross from Honduras into Mexico, the federales are going to try to send you back to Honduras
exactly.
too. So if you got through Mexico, that was its own trek.
And they're not all Mexicans
right.
who are coming here.
Well, they're not. So, but, you know, America has always been seen as that refuge that you could come and take part here. Even though we know that, you know, we just went through Memorial Day, and my father was a World War II vet, and I have his flag. You know, he passed away 16 years ago, and you know, I commented that this man served his country. When you look at his birth date, you realize he was only 16 when he went in. I had to have his dad sign him in to the Navy, and since he was black, he was in the Navy. And I had to look up what his insignia stood for. So where would they have relegated blacks on a ship during World War II?
Specifically next to the musicians?
In the galley.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't. So, I just buried my grandfather,
yes.
and he was a veteran, and I couldn't look up anything about him because everything about our people who were fought for America is still a secret.
Or Hmong.
Mm.
Yeah.
So but, he didn't get the burial that he...
Because
should
his
have
record
gotten,
is redacted because
right.
of the secret war.
So, but my point was is that here's a black vet returning from World War II, the big one, who was not given access to the GI Bill, who was not allowed to be a part of the American dream as all the other white GIs came back and were given access to the GI Bill, which allowed them to buy the houses in the suburbs that were being created, that, you know, and... And so it's agonizing to realize that your father fought for a country that did not give him equal access to take part in the American dream. Not, you know, things have changed a little. Some of us have been given that opportunity, thank God. But there are many other things when we have what's been happening on the border with these kids, with families who are traveling thousands of miles through all kinds of hardships to come here for freedom. Right. To be have their children yanked away, put in cages, and then they're locked up, given an 800 number or some kind of number of which they try to call, and it may take them months to reach anyone who can even tell them where their children are located. I mean, so at least this individual has ended this practice. How long is it going to take for these families to find their kids?
Mm-hmm. If we're having a conversation surfacing why in communities of color there are various reactions, one of the reactions that came up recently for my community is the fact that we just celebrated Juneteenth.
Oh.
So whereas America celebrates its Independence Day on July 4th, during Independence Day, my people were still enslaved in this country. So that celebration of that day, there's an acknowledgement that, okay, this country was founded and there are things that we like about this country, of course, as citizens, and we can have that pride, but it's always a dual pride because we have to have that also knowing that we were still enslaved at the time. So we celebrate June 19th because that's when, even though the 13th Amendment had already been passed, that's when the head of the army was sent to Galveston, Texas to read a proclamation saying you had to get rid of your slaves under penalty of death. Because people weren't complying with the amendment and were still keeping slaves. Like, it took that in order to really get. And then after that, this same thing that you just described about having to find children and family, mm-hmm. that's the same process that ensued after Juneteenth. We had to go back and find family and piece lives back together after this horrible institution in bondage and subjugation that was happening, including the many folks who came up here to Minnesota. So with Bobby Hickman in that first group that started Pilgrim Baptist Church in the Rondo neighborhood, which is another reverberation because we have a removal of houses and families having to, this pattern of having to piece our families back together is not new. And so this conversation, that's part of the conversation, at least in my community circle, speaking for self, right? of having to have this conversation and the memories and the shadows of all these things that have happened come right back to the surface. So that's some of the things that are drawing the emotions and
reliving that pain. I mean, you know, I do this exercise with the students in our social work program that take my comparative racial ethnic analysis class, but I do it on historical trauma in the American Indian community. And so as I'm doing this exercise, I'm talking about the policies that were put in place. Because as a group, you know, in America, in the country built on religious freedom, in 1890, ours was outlawed. All right? In 1890, after Wounded Knee, after they killed 300-400 Lakota Indians practicing the ghost dance, American Indian religion was outlawed. So they took away who we were culturally. Then they put in place the boarding schools to speed up assimilation. So they removed our kids. And so during this exercise, I'm going through the different policies that were put in place to purposely try to speed up assimilation and wipe us out. The reservations were created, and hopefully, because they really thought that we would just die off. And we almost did. If you look at the Census Bureau, at the beginning of the 20th century, according to the census, there were 225,000 American Indians left in this country. So they almost wiped us out. Now think about that. I was born in 1954, right? So 54 years after that. So I come from a very small amount of individuals that survived, you know. That's the history of this country that is not taught. What is that saying they tell us? History has a way of repeating itself. And, you know, I often wondered, well, why does history repeat itself? Why don't we learn from those past histories? And I think we're seeing an example living through it right now with the conversations you're having. Yeah. History's repeating itself, but many individuals are unaware that this is a repetitive practice.
And just thinking about what you said, Anthony, about always trying to collect your family back together, just reminded me of, I recently lost my grandfather, who I was very close to, and he was telling me the story about how after the U.S. abandoned us, we had to flee. And everybody lost contact with everybody else, and how they try to recollect and re-find everybody in refugee camps. And it made me think of my mom now, who, you know, I live 5 miles from her. She thinks it's too far away. And it's so unbearable for her to think that one of us would get a job in Florida or California and move away, because that's separating the family to the point where it's traumatic. And I never really thought about that until you said that right now, about always trying to collect your family.
Again, that word, that phrase historical trauma, with that word historical at the beginning, you know, it's one thing for me as a white man to have learned about historical trauma, and it's easy to say, oh, well, if you're a descendant of a slave, Anthony, then, okay, I could see how, you know, that was passed down through family lore, and that's hard, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's also interesting to think about what's happening now, because I know that if Luz were here, she would be talking about the psychological trauma of children being separated from their parents as they have been at the border. That's historical trauma happening right now.
But it's trauma happening right now.
And it will become historical trauma.
Exactly.
In the future, but we don't connect it. It's hard for people to connect or to stay with that story to say, well, in 5 years or in 10 years, how are those kids going to be doing?
And that piece is what is the most heartbreaking, especially dealing with kids on a regular basis. You know, it reverberates in a whole lot of different areas, both past and present, because I've also come from a community where I know I'm this is also, it goes really, 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 really for Native communities. We have right now our internal battles about the removal of Native children from their homes at rates that are ridiculous for reasons that aren't the same for other populations. And the separation of families.
And by the way, you're talking about present day. You're not present talking about day. Boarding
talking about
schools.
Today. Yep. I'm talking about today. But also more recent history. There's a separation, it just from my, because I can only speak from my perspective. We have a separation from families on plantations systematically in order to control. We have a separation of families systematically once incarceration happens post-Reconstruction, because we have to repopulate our free workforce and free labor force. And so you have prison labor being farmed out from states to make income. And with things like fence post laws and vagrancy laws, you know, to fact the idea that you could go to jail post slavery for not having a job, and then you're farmed out for prison labor.
And then the old aid for family and dependent children program, you could not collect your benefit if the mail was around.
Yep, getting there.
And so these continual policies continually destroyed Black families. And other families, low-income families, but it had a huge negative impact on African-American families. And not just that, you know, I mean, part of the discussion I'm seeing on my social media feed is that American Indians are beginning to kind of come out of the woodwork, because this hits so close to home mm-hmm. for us as indigenous individuals in this country, of having our children removed and sent to boarding schools. But the fact that you know, for African-American and Native American kids, our children are removed at these incredibly high rates, much like African-American children were. I mean, currently, I think the last statistics I was aware of, it's still for both groups are between 25 to 28%. But what was heartbreaking were the number of individuals who were acknowledging in social media that this hurt them so bad, they were acknowledging that they were removed from their parents mm-hmm. in 1970 or 1980. Or, I mean, we're just talking, you know, American Indian kids who are admitting on social media that they lived this experience.
Oh, and I can remember just me being young. We were recipients of all kinds of benefits and had to stay in a shelter or two and the lectures. So there's the policy removal that's already there, but then there's all the stuff in between there that we don't talk about because it's not on paper. It's the lectures that folks gave. You know, my mom is raising us with all of these different things that she doesn't have, you know, just showing the brilliance of women in my community and my family and my mother, right? I hear the things that you talk about, Hlee, when you talk about how your mom took care of you all and all those types of things. I mean, these are signs of the most resilient, powerful women and men and families who are persevering all these things, right? It's shocking to me that all of this conversation is happening and we are ignoring the fact that they made it this far, this way, to do this many things to try to get out of these horrible situations. And that's something that all of us have a history. That is something that all of us have a history through. If I have survived the potato famine and all of the persecution that I had as an Irish person being seen as Black first in this country mm-hmm. before I had to do things to gain access to a white identity, there are all of these stories about people going through all these things. But for some reason, I'm being facetious, and for some reason, But in this conversation, we're only talking about, in a lot of conversations, the legality of crossing a border right. illegally yes. and yes. not all the stuff around it that mm-hmm. matters so much more.
But what do you do with that? Because that is absolutely something you hear, that this entire conversation about the trauma of separating children and don't give me your lectures about this history and that history, that's none of that is warranted, because the moment that family crossed the border in a non-legal fashion, they were committing a crime, and therefore
it's a misdemeanor.
Well, but
I mean, it's a misdemeanor. It's not even like it's not even a felony to cross the border illegally. And you know, at one point, Native Americans practicing their religion was illegal.
Yes.
Not, you know, Black people were owned. That was law. Just because it's illegal or legal now doesn't mean it's right.
Or doesn't make it just.
Exactly.
And so, you know, but you bring up a good point, because earlier, I think on NPR, I was listening to a discussion in terms of police chases, right? And the fact that many different police departments have policies in place now because of the incident that happened over in North Minneapolis where the state patrol was chasing an individual in his SUV from the freeway into the side streets and chased him up through a park where he ran over and killed a two-year-old and hit the two-year-old sister.
Did the one die? I know that they were both injured. Maybe there was some very serious injuries.
Still be in the hospital. Yeah. So correction.
Yeah,
but still,
but it was a horrible, horrible. Just think about that.
And they, so on, and it was a moving violation that started the chase, which is a misdemeanor. Okay, so just to give you an idea, and so we're having this debate on whether or not, you know, many police departments have put policies in place. If it's a moving violation, like a ticket or whatever, what's the purpose of chasing them? It's a misdemeanor to cross the border. So Trump's actions were taken purposefully, all right, to send a message. I mean, and he sent a message. And it was, I'm going to separate these children or you give me the money to build the wall.
We also left the UN Human Rights Council. Right. So what does that mean? I mean,
the fact that they withdrew the United States.
We withdrew from that while we're separating children on Juneteenth. Like,
think about that. I mean, the symbolism is incredible, isn't it?
Okay. However,
I mean,
however, I don't know that I had an effect that hit me largely because I'm unaware. And this is where I find myself in a very interesting place of cognitive dissonance in that the statement from our representative, Nikki Haley. Thank you.
Nikki Haley.
Her statement, when she made her statement, I had to go, oh, okay. And her statement was the UN, the Human Rights Council, what have they done? Right. And my first assumption is, well, I assume because of this UN Human Rights Council, they have done all these different things. But then I had to go back and look, and I can't answer that question. So when the statement was made of, so we're pulling out because the only reason they have credibility is because the U.S. is there, and without the U.S. there, they have to account for what they have or have not done. I'm now stuck in this hyperbolic loop of going, well, wait, how unspecific is that? Like if I can say here's all the opportunities that were there and they didn't and we're pulling out because they're not doing their job and we want to do X, Y, and Z and put something on the table. That's how usually an intelligent decision to leave something like this goes.
That's not the story I heard from my grandfather before he died about the UN and the assistance that the Hmong got from the UN.
That is in the vacuum of that knowledge when you're talking about educating. In the vacuum of that knowledge, that statement that she made, you could do a logical dance that make you go, oh, okay, and not necessarily go deeper.
Let me follow your line of thinking because, you know, when you look at that Human Rights Commission, all right, and, you know, one thing that I always found hypocritical about the U.S. is how the powers that may be that represent our country would go throughout the world and point to other countries how they're committing human rights violations by discriminating against this population or that population while they did the same thing here against us.
I'm reminded of Malcolm X going to the UN and to bring the U.S. on charges of what we were doing to African Americans during that time.
Oh, right? Yes.
I'm being a little facetious around Nikki Haley's statement.
But okay, well, here's the thing around her statement.
Well, she threw in personal biases.
It's like that argument and that thinking that you just outlined for us. It's like when people say, we can't have gun control laws because no matter what, if somebody wants to kill someone with a gun, they're going to get a gun and kill them. So let's just not have any gun control laws at all. That's how I feel about it. We say we're in this commitment for human rights, but we haven't really done anything proactive about it. So let's just leave. There is also just the point of saying you're committed to human rights that is important.
It tried to do this dance to bypass any conversation about the actual things that the Human Rights Commission
yes.
has done,
yes.
for which there is a substantial right. list of things across
right.
the world.
Right.
That but has because been done. Americans don't see that every day, they, mm-hmm. they're going to believe that, wow, they haven't done anything for us.
The other, by the way, moment this week in which the Commission on Human Rights for the United Nations was in the news was when the UN High Commissioner for mm-hmm. Human Rights criticized the United States
right.
for its policy for of separating children.
I feel like if every time somebody talks bad about us, we're going to like retaliate. This is just like, there's going to be...
So you say we by association. I
we
mean,
by
because,
association.
Exactly.
As in the U.S., it's like, you know, when you're in high school and somebody says something mean about you and then you go around saying something mean about them or you're like, I'm not your friend anymore because you said something mean. About this is how I feel like this country is being run right now.
Well, I mean, think about the pattern that we've talked about on yes. Counter Stories before,
exactly.
right? Of we can do more than one thing at a time. And all of our and this is one of the hard parts about racial discourse in particular is, you know, the assumption that if I'm going to criticize this thing over here, that means that all the other things, I have to lump you into a camp or everything else about you is bad as well. Communities of color haven't been part of that practice. We can have a conversation critiquing the U.S. at one time and still cheer for the moments of success
yes.
that makes us who we are. You know, we can still go across and have a healthy critique of this country, which is venerated in certain circles in dominant culture. Having a healthy critique of our nation is venerated in one population, mm-hmm. but when it's done in communities of color, often it is met from our white peers in dominant cultural spaces as if we're lumping everybody together
yes.
and calling everybody racist at the same time. It's like
or
we can't have more than one
patriotic.
Conversation
yes.
at the same
it's
time. I can't be two
or.
Things at once.
It's both.
It's right. that, like, you know, and you know, often on Counter Stories, I've shared that, you know, as a biracial Native American, African American, but as a person of color, always said that from my perspective, neither party stands mm-hmm. for who I truly am. And much like Anthony said, you know, there's a history once the Democrat and Republican Party switched, because Lincoln is a member of the Republican Party at one time, but it has switched. The platforms of the two parties switched. But there are many Democrats who gave us much lip service and mm-hmm. never followed through.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I was to look at myself, theoretically, I'm a social worker. I'm a progressive. But part of me is also a bit conservative, although, yeah, I'll pay more taxes to ensure that there are services for all Americans so that we all do well. But I'm not no right-wing conservative, and I'm no, I think, really far left person either. I mean, there's a middle ground that I think a lot of us are a part of, and we can't have those conversations anymore.
And maybe it's those voices that we need to hear more. Than the extreme.
One of the things I wanted to bring out is right, left, middle, to me, is an oversimplification that also mutes voices, because that implies that there's a camp somewhere in there. And one of the things I've been trying to get folks to understand is, particularly as far as communities of color are concerned, it's much more complicated than that. There's not a firm foot in any one of those pieces. That in one conversation, just have a conversation in a black church community around LGBTQ issues, and you are going to get folks who are conservative, folks who are liberal, folks who are in between, folks who, if we're talking about church membership, might be a little bit more accessible. When we're talking about church marriage, they can not at all, and that's all happening in the same body. And so, if my issue is, and I keep bringing this up, is our inability to have a complex mm-hmm. and contextual conversation,
yes.
which
right.
is what communities of color have to have because we're in so many different camps. And that's what I'm not seeing in this conversation about the border.
I think that what there is not agreement on, to before I start naming 7,000, is the vision. What is the overarching theme? Are we a welcoming country or not? Do we want people to come in or not?
See, now that's a little bit different mm-hmm. than it needing to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a different conversation. And because it was fine as long as they were coming from Europe. It was not fine once they started coming from other countries. And that's the history of the United States. And so that's when discussion in terms of needing to fix immigration started, is when immigrants started coming from countries other than white European countries. which just adds to the history of this whole debate.
So every topic we talk about, you're right. Immigration, we talk about immigration, but immigration affects the workforce. The workforce affects the economy. Everything affects everything else in this country.
Yes.
And I understand we have 70,000 other things around immigration to talk about, but this there's an urgency to children being in cages.
Right.
You know, so that's the thing for me right now is there's so much we need to do. There's so much that we need to talk about. But right now, my worry is for the children.
Mm-hmm.
And that, because it's so extreme, that's what's causing this urgency from people, is that, you know, we have visuals of how extreme this is, how extreme it's become. And maybe this will spark better conversations around immigration reform at Congress. Hopefully it will, but, you know, just it's urgent.
But we're doing something that we don't have to do. It was a choice to inflate this this happening, right?
Yes.
We don't have to do it this way.
No.
And we can have all these other conversations, but please, I thank you for bringing us back to that point, is this is not something we have to do. Mm-hmm. And it's ridiculous. And so many people agree with that one. I mean, it's such a unifying thing. For the first time in a long time, I'm having conversations with folks who right, left, middle, all the connections in between and the concoctions that mix them all. You know, it is possible to be liberally, conservatively progressive. I can give you some archetype pieces of that, right? But no matter what that is, everybody's talking about, where I've had contentious back and forth from folks all over the perspective piece on this issue, there hasn't been a break. There hasn't been a fight. It's been everybody posting like, what the royal hell? I'm trying to make sure I watch my language. Yeah. You know?
Well, again, as always, when we come to the end of a conversation, there's more we could have talked about, but we have the time constraints that we do, and we're at the end of our conversation.
Well, we're in agreement. Send us your poor huddled masses that we may.
And before we're done, Tom, I want to thank you. I know this is your last week at NPR, and it's been amazing to have you join our team and to get to know you. And I hope that you do come back and visit us. I know some people thought it was weird, like people of color and a white guy. And I just always thought that you added that perspective that we needed to our conversation. So I just want to thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I got to add to that. Just the modeling, you know, of being in a space that is by people of color, for people of color, and the amount of listening and bringing things in. And then the stuff you do outside of our group, you know, the way that we are able to have conversations outside of this where you explore the things that you don't know, but keep your identity in doing so. You know, I valued that. Which is why we love it every time you're in the circle. So I appreciate your work on that as well.
Thank you.
And, you know, Tom, you know, many people don't know that, you know, there were changes that happened to the original counter stories. And many, many of our listeners aren't aware that, you know, you kind of saved us as a podcast and kept us going here at NPR. And I, too, you know, want to express my gratification getting to know you, what you've done with us. I always appreciated your honesty. Yeah, I like Halea, you know, we always thought that, you know, this is still a podcast by people of color and for people of color, but having your voice added to it, I thought just added that because you were honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I still remember you asking us about the Philando Castile thing over Thanksgiving and the fact that you admitted that you didn't have to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that kind of open honesty, I think, that helped our conversation. And so I, too, just want to wish my...
Well, thank you.
Sad to see you going, bud.
Well, I mean, I'm leaving NPR, but who knows what the future holds. And as this conversation continues, perhaps there'll be a chance for me to pop in from time to time, and I would enjoy that as well. So
it's recorded. We got that on recording.
That's on tape. It's on tape. So I'm Tom Weber.
Lily.
Don Eubanks.
Anthony Galloway.
And we'll see you next time. Thanks. We'll be right back.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.